and those others who are willing to join us. Gigi, I see you have a couple there, and I'm assuming others are joining by their computers. So good to see you. Today, well, first of all, for my class, next week is the last class before your papers are due. Your papers are due December 13th. And remember, it's 2 to 4 pages. It's in the syllabus. If you have questions, please email me and or give me a call, and I'll be happy to answer them. Next week's not going to be a lecture. It's going to be a conversation about everything that we've heard over the last 13 weeks, 12 weeks. So encourage you to be there. I think it'll be interesting and maybe hopefully give you some ideas for your papers if you don't have any yet. Today, we get to talk to one of my favorite scientists, Brad Udall. I worked with USGS, and I found that most scientists don't have a sense of humor, but Brad does. And he also is very capable at explaining very complex issues, technical issues, on a level that most people can understand. Brad is a senior water and climate research scientist scholar at the Water Center. He's focusing on Colorado River issues now with his climate research. He's been involved with the national climate assessments and the international climate assessments. So he's got a lot of good experience, and I'm going to turn it over to Brad. Thank you so much for being here, Brad.
Thanks, Jennifer, for your kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for joining me today. Let me start off and say that this is not especially a happy talk. I've given versions of this recently to basically dead, stunned silences, and I now call myself the skunk in the room. Hopefully in our conversation at the end, I can give you some hope. I don't know that there's a whole lot of hope in these slides, but I do have some hopeful things to say, and let's find a way to get there at the end. Feel free to interrupt this talk via the chat, and I'm told that somebody will be monitoring those and interrupt me if you have a question. By all means, there's nothing like listening to somebody drone on for 45 minutes without an interruption or two. So I encourage that. And with that as an introduction, let me start and talk about my material today. So this image I took in early October at a place called Bullfrog Marina. Bullfrog Marina is where people from Salt Lake City go to access Lake Powell. There's a car ferry from Bullfrog across the lake to a place called Hall's Crossing. And that ferry closed this year because Lake Powell dropped 50 feet this year. It's dropped about 150 feet since the year 2000. And you can see the ferry closed sign. You can see my white end of ramp marker here in this little canyon. And here's my car down in that canyon. There is no sign of Lake Powell anywhere near the end of this ferry ramp. And it was just so stunning for me to actually go to Bullfrog and see what's gone on this year. So I think you all by now probably have some background on the Colorado River, but this is sort of a mandatory stage setting. So 7 states, 2 nations, 30 tribes. We thought there were only 29 until recently. One of these tribes actually doesn't have a land base, and I think that's why it escaped people's acknowledgement. It's 8% of the area of the lower 48. The 20th century annual flow is about 15.2 million acre feet. It's roughly the size of the Hudson River. The worst drought in the gauged record going back to 1906 started in the year 2000. And that drought is now about 12.3 million acre feet, which is just under 20% on an annual basis. 40 million people in the American Southwest depend on this river. Every major Southwestern city gets water out of it, including lots that are a long ways from the basin or in the case of Arizona, very much uphill. Central Arizona Project in Arizona runs 336 miles, 3,000 vertical feet into Tucson. 4.5 million acres, irrigated acres, including many important acres that deliver our winter vegetables in places near Yuma and in the Imperial Irrigation District right down there on the California-Mexico border. It was fully allocated in 1922. There are really complex agreements known as the Law of the River. Around 2000, for the first time, the withdrawals equaled supplies. People are still contemplating, believe it or not, new projects like the Lake Powell Pipeline, or even in this state, water into Aurora and Colorado Springs, potentially. So that's a quick overview. Here's what I want to talk about: the current basin status. I want to talk about these really unusual flows, this drought since 2000, briefly talk about a south to north flow decline pattern, which fits a projection that climate scientists have been making for a very long time. I want to talk about the recent 20-month period and its contribution to the drought and the really large declines in precipitation we've seen, the role of heat in reducing river flows, role of precipitation in reducing river flows. You can't really call this a drought anymore. And so scientists now have a new term, aridification, to describe what's going on here. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, AR6 or 6th Assessment Report findings. So let's get on to it. So this year in August, for the first time ever, what's called a tier one shortage was declared for next year because Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir, is going to fall below 1075 feet. And based on rules that were established in 2007 and then additional rules in 2019, that puts us in what's called a tier one shortage. And all these articles go to the international interest in this: The Economist, CNN, Washington Post, CBS 60 Minutes. I've had interviews with French radio and radio in China, radio in Spain on this topic. So it has gotten a whole lot of interest. I thought I'd just show this. This winter's off to a dismal start. And all those red colors are, you know, in the 30% of normal at the end of November here. Long way to go. Could still recover, but obviously not a great start to our winter. And this is the drought monitor, which shows this big drought in the West that has gotten a little bit better since this summer, but still is basically West-wide. And these images show temperature trends over the last 30 years. NOAA and others use what are called 30-year climate normals. And you can see the average temperature trends for the whole year here on the left, well over a degree Fahrenheit per decade. And then winter, less warming here in Colorado, and summer, much more warming, especially in the whole western region here. And these are precipitation trends, 1991 to 2000. Again, our climate normals, you can see these subtle declines, or maybe not so subtle, at least compared to California, but declines in our state, in Arizona, New Mexico. And then what's interesting is the split between winter here in the upper right, some winter wetness, although this is really due to the 10-year period from 91 to 2000. And if you were to do this, look at this from 2000 on, you'd see slight declines in winter, and then summer here on the bottom, much more pronounced. And I'm going to talk a little bit about these summer declines in precipitation, how historically we would have thought that they didn't matter very much, but we now have a much more complete picture. And these summer precipitation declines actually are turning out to be quite important. So this image shows the contents of Lakes Mead and Powell, the nation's two largest reservoirs going back to 1935. And the first portion of this out to 1963, there's only Lake Mead. Then Powell fills, there's a drought in the late 80s into the early 90s, it refills, and then we have this huge decline. that's happened since. And the dotted portions here are projections out the next year. We're headed to less than 30% full, 15 million acre feet total from 47 million acre feet in January 2000, 95% full. And so over these 22 years, we've lost 32 million acre feet, twice the annual flow measured by the 20th century, and more like 2.5 times this new flow we've experienced since the year 2000. And that 1.4 million acre feet number, I want you to remember, because I'm going to come back to it later, it's the amount that if all these agreements go into place, if Lake Mead continues to drop, that amount actually will be cut from lower basin demand. So that trip I took down to Lake Powell in early October, I also took the image on the right, and you can see the Colorado River here running off north into Canyonlands National Park. The image on the left is a stock photo that was pointed out to me after I posted these on Twitter. This is the exact same spot. See this rock right here in the left image, same rock in the right image. In the year 2000, there you go. There's Lake Powell full. Just a stunning difference in the contents in this reservoir. It really brings home these just shocking changes. All right, so let's talk about this flow decline. And I want to do it in terms of two different sets of numbers. One called natural flows. These are artificially constructed flows at a place called Lee's Ferry, the dividing line in the Colorado River Compact between the upper basin and the lower basin. And then in the next slide, I'm going to talk about flows that actually flowed into Lake Powell. So these are artificially recreated. They take gauges and add reservoir evaporation and all the demands they can find back into them to make a set of flows that would have occurred were humans not around. And so the question here is, how are these last 22 years different from 1906 through 1999? The mean flow, 15.2 versus 12.3, and 19% decline. I've already been through this. And there's the two periods. The high flow years, that is to say flows that are greater than 15 million acre feet, we now get half as many of those flows as we got in the 20th century. And low flow years, which is to say flows below 10 million acre feet, we get 2.5 times as many. I did a simple Monte Carlo reconstruction, and I tried to see if I could generate the flows that have occurred since 2000, just using the flows from 1906 to 1999. And using the simplest of techniques, you find out this only happens once every 1,500 years. And if you look at 22-year periods in the 20th century period and in the 21st century period, they're quite different. So the 1906 to 1999, 13.1 million acre feet. From 2000 to 21, 12.4. If you do the math, that's 700,000 acre feet per year. That's, you know, more than twice what the state of Nevada gets. But if you multiply that 700,000 acre feet per year by the 22 years, you get the total volume that's missing. That's 15.4 million acre feet. So these two reservoirs, instead of containing about 15 million acre feet, would now contain 30 million acre feet. It's really different. These two periods are really different. And my take home on this whole slide is that there's no 20th century analog to the last 22 years. The last 22 years are completely different. So the second way to look at these flows are just to look at what flowed into Powell. And these are or would have flowed into Powell without reservoir operations upstream, the so-called unregulated inflows into Powell. And so we've just pulled out the upstream reservoir operations. It's a gauge number, set of gauge numbers. And if you added upper basin demands back into these, you'd get back to my earlier slide. You'd have something like natural flows. So the 2000 to 21 average is 8.4 million acre feet per year. And there it is in blue. And what's so interesting about these flows is that they're tied directly to something in the Colorado River Compact, what's called the Section 3 non-depletion provision, or sometimes people have called it a delivery obligation from the upper basin to the lower basin. And that delivery obligation is 75 million acre feet every 10 running years, or on an annual basis, 7.5 million acre feet. You should note that you cannot release from Lake Powell more than comes in. That is to say that 8.4 million acre feet less evaporation. And evaporation is probably 500,000 acre feet. So what we can release to the lower basin is 7.9 million acre feet. The Section 3 non-depletion provision plus what is commonly interpreted as our obligation to meeting half of the Mexico delivery obligation is typically taken to be 8.23 million acre feet. And so effectively what we have to release, the 7.9, it's less than that 3D plus Mexico non-depletion amount, 8.23. And this has not been widely talked about, but what it means is that the upper basin, if these flows continue, are heading to an interesting discussion with the lower basin at the very least over what that 3D section really means. All right, so let's talk a little bit about where these flows have declined. And this image is an older climate model projection of changes in precipitation. The red is reductions in precipitation. The blue is increases in precipitation. You'll note kind of cutting through Colorado and Utah is this shift from red to blue. And we've always been worried that if this plays out, that you know, this state will have effectively winners and losers. And I've often thought that southwestern Colorado especially is at risk of precipitation declines. And so I just did a really simple analysis recently, and I looked at not the complete river at Lee's Ferry here, right at Lake Powell, but I looked at all the other places, and this data only goes to 2019 because I don't have a complete data set out to 2021. So the Lee's Ferry reduction's less than what I said. It's only 17, not 19. If you look at the San Juan near Bluff, it's at 30% loss. Green River near Green River, Utah at 15. Colorado River near Cisco is also 15. Dolores near Cisco, minus 21. And I hope you're starting to see a little bit of my pattern here where these southern systems seem to be losing more water. Colorado River near Cameo, right at Grand Junction, minus 9. Gunnison near Grand Junction, minus 17. So again, a little bit of a bigger hit on the southern river. As we go upstream at Glenwood Springs, only 6% loss. And then my pattern falls apart a little bit here. White near Watson, 19%. Yampa near Maybell, 6. Green near Greendale, below Flaming Gorge Reservoir, minus 17. Below Fontenelle, going further north at 15. So you do see a little bit of this pattern. And it just, I hadn't done this until recently, and it jumped out at me as something interesting. I've always thought that were the main stem Colorado here with minus 6% to really show large declines, that's where we in Colorado would really feel pain, because this is where many of the transbasin diversions come out of. They don't come out of the Gunnison. They're out of this main stem for the most part. And so that's something to watch as time unfolds. Here's a NOAA drought report, came out in September. They looked at the 20-month period from January 2020 to August 2021. They said it had the lowest total precipitation since 1895, the third highest daily average temperature since 1895, and what's called record high vapor pressure deficit. That is the atmospheric thirst for water, the kind of evaporative demand, if you will. And they indicated that the large precipitation decline appeared largely natural, but I'm going to put an asterisk on that and we'll come back to it in the next slides. And they say warm temperatures that helped to make this drought so intense and widespread will continue and increase, and still stringent climate mitigation is pursued. And this is really the money.
Before you go on, can we back up two slides, please?
Two slides.
Yeah, the stream flow.
Yeah.
So Gigi asked, have you looked at the elevation of snowpack in those watersheds? The Dolores has a lot of low elevation snowpack that can make a big difference in stream flow.
Yeah, and I haven't, and it's a great observation. And the Dolores was particularly challenged this year. There was an interesting national NPR story on the Dolores that, if you're at all interested in it, I encourage you to track it down. It's easy to find. But that's a really good observation. The San Juans, maybe a little less so though, right? I mean, they're the whole bunch of 14ers up there in the San Juans, I'd argue. So interesting observation. Good thing to think about.
And then there's another question. Are southern systems losing more water because they're getting closer to the equator, or is that because the basins are needing to divert the water more and more?
So the climatological theory around southern declines is that the deserts in Arizona and New Mexico should move poleward as it warms. Storm track should move poleward as it warms. That's the real theory behind this. And there's a really interesting researcher at the University of Arizona, Jo Ellen Russell, who I saw a fascinating talk recently. And she said she's completely supported this theory. It was a little different way of backing into it, but effectively she said Tucson used to see a whole number of slow moving storms in the winter where they get their precipitation. And now they see fewer storms and they're faster moving. And she ties this all up nicely in a polar vortex context that I don't really have time to get into, but the whole thing was pretty interesting, and it supported this notion of storm tracks moving northward.
Okay, Brett, thanks. Those were the two questions.
Great. All right, so this was the money slide here on that report, and the thing that jumped out at me was this southwestern U.S. precipitation. So the little dots there are 20-month periods calculated each year. And what was super interesting to me was just how low the last period is there. It's the one circled in green. And that certainly is concerning. So let me tie this into a number of papers. And these first set of papers really deals with the effects of heat on the flow reduction. And until recently, much of the focus on these flow declines in the Colorado River was not so much on a loss of precipitation, but what this extra heat is doing to these flows. So here's Connie Woodhouse, increasing influence of air temperature on Colorado River stream flow, bunch of well-known authors here. And what they found was that normally, we just think precipitation drives river flow, but temperature can also be a flow driver. Since 1988, flows have been less than expected given winter precipitation, which is to say runoff efficiency, the amount of water that shows up in our river for a given amount of precipitation has actually gone down since 1988. And she says warm temperatures exacerbated modest precipitation deficits in what we're calling the millennium drought, this period from 2000 on. And this image here, let's concentrate more on the bars. So there's green bars, blue bars, peach bars, and pink bars. And if you look over at 1988, you'll see predominantly we've got these pink and peach bars. And those are years in which runoff efficiency is low. And the two colors are in high flow years and in low flow years. That's the two colors. If you look over on the left side where you got green and blue, that's where runoff efficiencies are high. So again, in both high flow and low flow years. And hence her comment here, since 1988, flows have been less than expected. So this was the first paper that really pointed out something odd is going on in the Colorado River and temperature with respect to flows, and temperature is a part of it. And then in 2017, Jonathan Overpeck and I wrote a paper called The 21st Century Colorado River, Hot Drought and Implications for the future. And what we said, and it dovetails very nicely with Connie's work, precipitation declines only partially explain the flow loss in the river. And we suggested that you could explain about two-thirds of the flow loss due to lack of precipitation. But then you got to invoke something else, temperature, to explain that remaining 33%. And why? We were getting more evaporation. We've got a thirstier atmosphere that actually wants to suck up and hold more moisture. And what we suggested was that temperature-induced flow losses were now roughly about a third of the, at the time, 18% roughly flow loss. By 2050, if you just took climate model temperatures and assumed even precipitation, no change in precipitation, you could see 20% flow loss. And by 2100, 35%. And I'll note that if you want to adjust those for the lack of precipitation we've seen to date, add about 15% on to them, or 14%, 12%, whatever. So 2050 becomes well over 30%. And 2100 gets really high, close to 50%.
I had a question. How is basin temperature calculated?
How is basin temperature calculated? So there are a whole number of data sets out there that you can use to calculate temperature. For the paper I just referenced, we used a data set called PRISM, which is what's called a gridded data set. Since that time, NOAA has a brand new data set that's also gridded, called NCLIMB Grid. And those two data sets effectively show the same thing. They're based on station data, some of which goes back to 1895. And in the case of the newer NOAA NCLIMB Grid, they've gone to some lengths to remove a bunch of spurious artifacts that can create trends that don't really exist in time. There are also a number of other data sets out there you can use, but most of them ultimately come down to these individual station records located throughout the basin. And that's the data set we're using. So last year, here's another paper that deals with these temperature influences. And this paper is called Colorado River Flow Dwindles as Warming-Driven Loss of Reflective Snow Energizes Evaporation, to USGS scientists. And what they were trying to do was reconcile a very wide range of what are called Colorado River temperature sensitivity, which is to say how much the flow goes down per degree Celsius increase. And that range is about from 2.5% up to roughly 15%, depending on different studies and different techniques. And their answer was that for every degree Celsius increase, we lose about 9% of the flow of the river. And again, in Celsius terms, the basin's up about a degree and a quarter. Kind of depends on when you're measuring, when you start your measurement. But let's just say a degree and a quarter. Portions of the basin are actually over 2 Celsius. So Grand Junction, over 2 Celsius. So they went and did something similar to what Overpeck and I did and calculated out mid-century flow loss based on climate model temperature projections. And using both low greenhouse gas emissions and high greenhouse gas emissions, that number ranges anywhere from 14 to 31% flow loss. They also looked at what happens if you look at climate model precipitation. And again, using low and high greenhouse gas emissions. And the range there is maybe precipitation saves the day. Maybe we actually get a 5% increase in flow. But you also can lose precipitation. And so on the bottom end, you could lose 40% or more. And what they say is their key finding, that as this snowpack melts earlier, the Earth's surface becomes darker. It absorbs more energy. It heats up. You get more what's called evapotranspiration, more evaporation and plant water use transpiration. And that's about two-thirds of this flow loss. The image on the right is April run snow water equivalent here. So the amount of water in the snowpack, it declines through time. Albedo is the reflectivity of the surface of the Earth. So the Earth is getting darker here because we have less snowpack. And then net radiation, this is the sort of absorbed energy that's going into evaporation and transpiration is going up. All right, so shifting gears, we've had two fascinating years, the last two. In 2020, we had 100% of snow water equivalent on April 1, and it turned into 50% of runoff. And this year we had 90% of snow water equivalent, and it turned into 30% of runoff. And this gets into answering this question I hinted at earlier about why are these declines in summer precipitation so important? How do they tie into this picture? Because at first glance, if you have 100% of your snowpack on April 1, you'd think you'd have a pretty good year of runoff. Well, the picture's interestingly complicated. So this is a look at the snowpack above Lake Powell, and 2021 is marked here, and it's close to about 90% of average here. It's about 13 inches of snow water equivalent above Lake Powell, above Lee's Ferry. And we had close to average winter precip, but what happens? We are seeing large reductions in precipitation in March and April in the spring. This allows the snowpack to melt early. It allows plants to then start using water early because they green up sooner. And then what we've seen are these hot and dry summers reduce soil moisture. And when the runoff begins to happen the next year, that soil moisture that's now depleted absorbs a lot of the snowmelt that would otherwise historically have gone into the river. And this image here is soil moisture this year in April 2021. I'm getting some noise, excuse me. So this image here is April of this year, and you can see these pinks and purples represent very large soil moisture depletions that then absorbed the nearly normal snowpack and led to 90% of snow water equivalent turning into 30% of runoff. And so all of a sudden, this picture where we used to think, oh, it was just the winter snowpack and that determined our fate for water, that picture is not correct. It turns out that that spring precipitation is really important, as is the summer. And here's just a look at this year. On the left is a year ago, September 2020, inches to saturation, roughly 12 inches of depleted soil moisture in the Colorado River Basin. And this year, even after a pretty good monsoon, still pretty crummy. And so my sense here is watch out next year. So this ties into my notion here that summers are important and soil moisture is important. This is a paper from last year by really well-known scientists. Large contribution from anthropogenic warming to an emerging North American mega drought. Mega drought often being defined as a drought that lasts decades or longer. And what these scientists found was the 19-year period since 800 AD, this 2000 to 2018, 19-year period, was the second driest period as measured by June, July, August soil moisture. So here you go, soil moisture back into the picture. And they say that this decline or these very dry soils was partly natural variability, but it was aided by anthropogenic or human-caused drying. And about 50% of this drying was actually due to humans, a human cause. Without this anthropogenic component, this would actually be a pretty modest drought. So earlier,
let me interrupt. There's a question about this year. Did Southwest Colorado just have a high monsoon season, which is why we didn't have as bad of a drought as Front Range?
So I missed the question in there. Was it more of a statement or?
Well, I was just wondering if the Southwest did it just have a high monsoon season
dismal runoff. And again, that NPR story on what went on in the Dolores is worth looking at. I mean, the Ute Mountain Utes got something like 10% of their normal allocation, and they had roughly 10% of their fields in production because the water being allocated out of McPhee Reservoir in the Dolores was just so low. So that, you know, the one great thing about that monsoon this year was it kept fire danger down, right? In a normal, you know, if we'd had a repeat of 2020, which had a really hot and dry summer, we would have likely seen a whole number of big impactful fires in Colorado. We didn't see those, thankfully. A little bit of a blessing in that. I mean, a lot of a blessing, but it didn't do that much for water users, I would argue, in the western part, and especially southwestern part of the state, at least not that I'm aware of. All right, so I've been oftentimes calling this a drought or a mega drought. It's not really. I mean, this is something different. So some of us have come up with this term aridification, which is a complete mouthful. This article I wrote with Overpeck last year, and we just kind of laid out what this means, because it's not just happening in the Southwest. It's happening elsewhere, including in the upper Midwest, believe it or not. And there are all these components to aridification, declining snowpacks, earlier runoff 2 to 4 weeks earlier, more rain and less snow, these higher temperatures, drying soils, severe fires, forest mortality, this warm, thirsty atmosphere that wants to actually hold more moisture, northward moving storm tracks, these shorter winters. I mentioned the dry springs we've been experiencing, and just this whole combination of mega drought. And this is mostly a repeat. So why are these 21st century flows so different? So one, these temperature increases that have now been pretty well studied starting in 2016. And we probably lose, at least according to one study, about 9% of the flow of the Colorado River per degree Celsius increase. And then since 2018, these really large precipitation declines. And let me just rattle off these years. 2018, worst year since 1895 in terms of precipitation in the Upper Colorado River Basin. 2019, actually a pretty good year. 2020, bottom 10 year, and 2021, bottom 15 year in terms of precipitation in the Upper Colorado River Basin. So two causes right now, and they're both going in the wrong direction. This image is out of a Washington Post story from last year. They won a Pulitzer Prize on this series called 2 degrees C Beyond the Limit. Giant climate hotspot is robbing the west of the water. And you can see the whole western part of Colorado here, Grand Junction being right kind of here in the middle and into Utah as well. All right, shift gears. IPCC recently released its major findings in August. Humans have warmed all parts of our climate system. Widespread and rapid changes are occurring. This is unprecedented over centuries to thousands of years. We're seeing weather and climate streams across the globe being affected. Temperature is going to increase to at least mid-century, depending on when we finally cease emitting greenhouse gases. We're going to exceed both 1.5 and then 2 Celsius unless there are deep greenhouse gas reductions, and they need to start this decade. More warming leads to more harmful impacts. All of these studies, all the way going back to the year 2000, they all talk to how the hydrologic cycle intensifies as it warms. It means bigger droughts, bigger floods. It kind of seems unfair, but that's how the Earth system works when you warm it up. Many changes irreversible. We can't rule out these low likelihood, high impact events. You know, for example, Portland at what, 116 Fahrenheit, or that town in Canada, Lytton, that hit 121 and then was wiped out by a fire the next day. Good news is lower emissions lead to noticeable temperature changes within 20 years, and we're probably headed towards 2.7 degrees Celsius by 2100, should all these pledges that nations have made come to fruition. This kind of contrasts a little bit with that, or is sort of an inside story on it. Nature, the number one or two peer-reviewed magazine in the world, ran a survey of scientists that contributed to that last report. And the headline here on the survey results: top climate scientists are skeptical that nations will rein in global warming. A Nature survey reveals that many authors are anxious about the future and expect to see catastrophic changes in their lifetimes. I told you this wasn't a happy talk. I'm sorry. I wish I had nicer things to say, but boy, we need to be truthful with ourselves. One question: is the world experiencing a climate crisis? 88% yes. Do you think you will see catastrophic impacts of climate change in your lifetime? 82% yes. And then this is interesting here. You know, how much warming do you think you will see? And over 60% of scientists say 3 Celsius or more, which is really, 2 Celsius we should stay under, and boy, 1.5 would be a whole lot better. And 3 is just a different world. So I'll go back to this slide and then kind of shift here into some of the policy stuff in the last few minutes here. All the trends in the Colorado River Basin are wrong. Reservoirs, natural flows, upper basin precipitation, upper basin temperatures are all in the wrong direction right now. Here's a look at the agreed on shortages. And you can see over here on the right, the amount of shortages are going to happen this year, labeled at 713,000 acre feet. And then at the very bottom here, I mentioned that 1.4 million acre foot number, or 1.4 million acre foot total shortages that could happen, were Lake Powell, or Lake Mead, excuse me, to drop very, very low here at 1025 on the left, lower left. And interestingly, those two numbers align. A few super interesting stories recently. So just last week, California, Arizona, Nevada in talks on new plan to save Colorado River water. So they want to actually not do that 713,000 acre feet next year. They want to up that by 500,000 acre feet and what they're calling the 500 plus plan. And they say it would boost Mead by 16 feet over 2 years. They've come up with a whole bunch of contributions. They're trying to get to $100 million a year with some federal, state, and other money at about $200 an acre foot. So this is brand new, heavy duty talks. Idea maybe to announce a plan here in less than a month at a big meeting in Las Vegas. This story just came out a couple of days ago. Colorado River States balk at adjusting water shares to deal with crisis. And sort of the money quote here is from the director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Our challenge is now is not reallocating water. Our challenge is to collaborate to address the increasing hydrologic risks by developing additional innovative and proactive measures, including either voluntary or mandatory conservation. And so you sort of get the sense here, I mean, these states are trying to act as quickly as they can and talking about these bigger issues like reallocating shares they see as a diversion, right? It's really, that's a huge lift to ask them with next to no time. This is an editorial that I wrote with another academic, University of New Mexico, trying to get this notion of reasonable worst case planning. We need to talk about how you operate this river with super low flows. And that we can't just use the 20% decline that we've seen since the year 2000. We need to use something below that. We actually don't suggest what that number is, but are just strongly encouraging decision makers to try and get a system that's robust and resilient to additional flow declines. This is a paper that I was a co-author on with Kevin Wheeler and a number of other scientists. And basically what we said, the supply-demand balance in the system is really tenuous. And we did a bunch of modeling that had combined Meade and Powell storage. And these two lines here basically show what would happen to the combined Meade and Powell storage starting around 22 million acre feet, which was where it was when we started this. And if you use two different hydrologies, stress test, what's called a stress test hydrology, and the continuation of the current drought, this is with continued demand growth out of the upper basin. You see these reservoirs continue to decline out to 2050 and sort of stabilize at pretty low levels, lower than they are now. And then we ran the whole thing and did some additional modeling here. And the dotted lines have no increased demands out of the upper basin. So you're actually keeping the reservoirs higher, right? Again, with those two same hydrologies. And the take-home message, if you don't increase upper basin demands and recent flows are representative of the future, then the system sort of stays at sustainable but low levels. That's this pink or whatever reddish dotted line here at 15 million acre feet, which is where we're headed to. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about some solutions that have been suggested sort of in the non-policy, you know, law of the river world. This came out of a bunch of NGOs, many of whom are very active in the river. And they use this solution lens of adapting to climate change, reducing water pressure, mitigating climate change, so reducing greenhouse gases, and then sort of strengthening our resilience. And they listed 10 of these things, from forest management, restoration, natural distributed storage. Interestingly, beavers, believe it or not, come into the picture here, trying to store water up high in these wet systems, what's now called regenerative ag, upgrading ag infrastructure and operations, moving to alternative crops. Point six and seven deal with conservation and reuse, both in the urban and industrial setting. Turns out there are a number of coal plants in the Colorado River Basin that are going to retire, and that'll free up about 100,000 acre feet. Reducing dust on snow, which I haven't talked about, but seems to be losing about 5% of the flow relative to pre-human period. Dark, dirty snow melts sooner. And in some ways gets to exactly the problem I was describing earlier, where you get earlier green up. So whiter, cleaner snow would actually stay around longer and reduce problems, particularly an issue in the southwestern part of the state. And then finally, covering reservoirs and canals. And with that, I'm going to end. That's a huge amount of material. I didn't get the hope. Maybe we can get the hope. And I, again, apologize for being a skunk, but you know, when you're deep in a hole, the first thing you do is acknowledge kind of the nature of your problems, and then maybe you can get about to solving them. Thank you so much.
Brad, that was wonderful. If you'll stop sharing your presentation there, we will be posting that presentation on Canvas and on the website so that you can get those particular numbers. And Brad is always available to respond to questions. But let's turn it over to you all and say what questions do you have after all that you heard? Let's see, Brad, there was one in the chat. Any comments on the viability of subsurface water storage?
So, yeah, you know, and that gets to this sort of beaver idea, right, of trying to use these natural systems to store water up high. And, you know, I don't think we know very much about it. And I think we should, I mean, everything needs to be on the table here, including solutions that, you know, heretofore we've thought are bad or have some drawback, or we're in a deep hole here. And we need to put everything on the table and use the best science to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work, and implement those that do, and find other things or other things if some don't. So I completely agree, subsurface storage is got to be on the table here.
We have another comment that thanks you and says, excellent presentation. You need to do a TED talk. Have you heard from Ted yet?
No, I'm waiting.
Yeah. So Brad has been on 60 Minutes. He was on a PBS special a couple weeks ago. He's talked about, you know, some of the other people, reporters he's talked to. Brad, I have a question for you. What, when these reporters are talking to you, do they get it, or are they still at a surface level understanding?
Jennifer, I think it depends on which reporter you're talking about, right? I mean, there are a number of reporters in the basin that have covered this story for years, and I think get it. You know, the Ian Jameses and the Tony Davises get it. And there's others as well here in Colorado, Luke Runyon and Michael Sakas from Colorado Public Radio. And there's a new reporter at KUNC who's getting up to speed quickly. So, you know, these local reporters understand stuff, I think, quite well. Water's a complicated story to tell, and they oftentimes don't have a lot of airtime or print to deal with it. But I think for the most part, they do a great job. You know, in the case of the national press, it's not so clear. And I don't blame them. It's just a, you know, it's a harder story to convey to somebody in New York City or Washington, D.C. about how this whole system works. So kind of a mixed bag, but I would tell you locally, I'm mostly really impressed with the local reporters that try and cover this.
I agree.
You know, and they're time. I mean, I don't mean to, you always get in trouble when you mention some names and not others, right? I mean, Jared Smith and Heather Sackett. And I mean, there's just tons of really good reporters out there that Brett Bovey. And I mean, I'm going to get in trouble because I didn't mention a few people.
Dixie, why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
So when you're presenting or conveying like the sheer scale of aridification, I said it right, I think, but is there a specific like picture or graph where you can see someone's eyes kind of get that aha moment where they start to get it? Like, is there one that is kind of a go-to if you have a scale of, let's say, 5 to 10 minutes of trying to get this across as opposed to 45 or 60.
You know, I wish I had a great answer for you on that. And I think what you're hinting at here is just the power of imagery, right? And what I sort of need to do is take that aridification slide and make it into a cartoon sort of image, maybe. I find the IPCC has a number of cartoon, what I call cartoon, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. You know, it's a drawing, a simplified drawing is what I mean by cartoon, that, you know, shows water cycle changes. And sometimes I'll show those. Cartoons sometimes are frustrating because you know, you can't get enough into them. But I mean, you're arguing, I think, here for simplicity, and I completely agree. Trying to distill this down to really simple stuff's important. And that's something all scientists have a challenge with.
Yeah, I think, Brad, you've done a good job with your charts and analysis, but it still gets complicated. Another question, this is from Esther Vincent from Northern. Can you speak to the potential implications to the Upper Basin states, Colorado in particular, and its heavy reliance on Trans Mountain diversions? What does it mean for the Front Range?
Ooh, great question, Esther. So the worry in the Upper Basin, right, is a violation of that Section 3D 75 million acre foot, whatever it is. I mean, for years, academics called it a delivery obligation, but that's not the right way to frame it. If you read the compact, it's a non-depletion obligation. And it says the upper basin shall not cause the flow to drop below 75 million acre feet. So what if climate change causes that flow to drop by below 75 million acre feet? Whose responsibility is it then? No one knows how that plays out. And arguably, I mean, the upper basin is completely underutilizing their compact share, according to 3A of the compact, which allocates what's called beneficial consumptive use of 7.5 million acre feet to each, the upper basin and the lower basin. The upper basin's using about 4 million acre feet plus reservoir evaporation, so maybe 4.5 total, way under their 7.5. And they historically, thought that they had cut a deal in 1922 to develop at their own rate and not be threatened by fast lower basin development, especially California, because they knew if there was a race to develop, they would lose. So, you know, in the case of Northern, whom Esther works for, it's a post-compact diverter. And were the upper basin to decide that they violated that clause, and they're the cops on this, as I understand it, they get to decide. It potentially means that all post-compact diverters, including major transbasin diverters like Northern and Denver Water and Aurora and Colorado Springs, all could potentially be cut off from their from about half of their water supplies. Mm-hmm. I mean, half the water in the Front Range here is transbasin water out of the Colorado River. So this is as real and as serious as it gets. The problem is, I mean, we don't know how you would actually violate 3D, given that it's never been violated, and given that, again, the non-depletion language around this, it's really unclear. And if you ask me, I mean, here's what I would tell you. The solution in this involves something called shared sacrifice. Everybody is going to have to bring something to the table if these flows go down. Ideally, at least as a starting point, what you bring to the table is proportional to your water use. That's shared sacrifice. This is such a fascinating, you know, question to me and everybody else who's engaged on this. How do you resolve this? And you know, what's equitable? What's fair? How do we respect the makers, the negotiators of the Colorado River Compact and their ideas, but how do you also, you know, acknowledge these 21st century realities? And the problem actually then gets even further complicated because potentially additional upper basin depletions then put everybody else in the same boat of having to contribute to a solution. That is to say, a Northern or a Denver Water contributing to a solution that some Johnny-come-lately new diverter causes by their additional depletions. I don't know. The whole thing is fraught, Jennifer, as you well know, and Esther, as you well know. And how you solve this is going to take a lot of clear heads. It's going to take a lot of people committed to solving it. And that's where at least I have a little hope here in the basin, in that there are tremendous working relationships amongst the different states and a bunch of different users. And yeah, the elbows get out for sure. But I think everybody agrees more or less that we hang together or we're going to hang separately. And hanging together is a far better outcome than trying to retreat to, you know, typical Western water right battling over who's first in line. Because that is just going to lead to, I think, a bad outcome. So,
and Brad, I would include in that the Republic of Mexico, too. They understand and have voluntarily taken shortages. So they're part of the conversation. CJ, you had a question?
Yes, I did. My question, Brad, was about the slide where you showed the NGOs, sort of, I think, top 10 recommendations. Is the retirement of coal-fired power plants getting at thermoelectric power generation?
Yep. That's exactly what it is, right? And, you know, Navajo Generating Station, they blew it all up, basically. I want to say just last year, that was 30,000 acre feet of depletions in Lake Powell being charged to Arizona that's no longer there. I mean, it's stunning. I was there in October. There's no, you know, 700 foot tall smokestacks. It's gone. And that's the wave of the future. And it's, you know, it's mostly being driven by economics. There's certainly some pressure on the climate side to quit burning coal because it's effectively the worst thing we could be burning. But a lot of this is just pure economics.
I had one more follow-up question.
Okay.
You know, do you think that we'll see some massive infrastructure projects to move water around the country from areas that have excess precipitation to those that have lacking precipitation? You know, if you look at a map of oil pipelines, I mean, the It's just amazing how it spans the whole country, and it seems like you can get almost anything anywhere. Do you foresee something like that coming in the future in regard to water?
You know, I don't, mostly based on the previous historical attempts to do that have been completely shot down. And, you know, one thought has been to take Missouri or Mississippi water, pump it into the Front Range. And so we would use less. And that runs smack dab into people in the Front Range saying, hey, we've got really high quality water. We're not drinking that crummy Missouri water. And so then if you got to take it over the Continental Divide, move it even further, it becomes yet more expensive. So this idea has been kicking around for decades and it's never happened. You know, under climate change, anything is possible, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, everything gets be put on the table to solve these problems, but I'm not an optimist that that's a solution here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Well, Brad, thank you so much. This was very interesting. Lots of good information and lots of things to think about. You're getting a whole bunch of kudos, applaud from all of us to you. And thanks, everyone, for being here. And we'll see you next week. Have a good week.